From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sarah Dwider.
And I'm Clara Izupidis.
This week on War News Radio, Determined Voices. First, we hear about a crackdown on the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq during a recent demonstration in Baghdad.
Then, we speak to acclaimed photojournalist John Moore about the recent death of his colleague, Chris Hondros, in Libya, a death that rocked the journalism community.
Finally, we hear from the journalists of Basetrack about the controversial cancellation of their embedment and a curious military response to the group's Facebook community.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Nearly 6 weeks after the death of Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda issued an online statement announcing that Ayman al-Zawahiri would assume the chief position within the organization. While al-Zawahiri has threatened that al-Qaeda will continue their fight against the United States and Israel, U.S. officials have dismissed him as a less significant threat than bin Laden because he has less influence than the former al-Qaeda leader.
The White House issued a statement defending the president's ability to authorize continued U.S. involvement in Libya. In a 38-page report, White House officials countered criticisms from lawmakers and Congress that there are no legal grounds for the U.S. military operations. Under the 1973 War Powers Resolution, the president can sustain military operations for 90 days before having to seek the approval of Congress. However, the White House report stated that the resolution does not apply since American forces have not actively exchanged fire with hostile forces, and because these operations have been carried out in association with NATO and the United Nations.
The Syrian National Army was deployed to the town of Murat al-Nauman to disperse protesters on Tuesday in the latest of a series of crackdowns. According to the United Nations, civilian protesters calling for government reform have been attacked and subjected to mass arrest and torture. The UN reports that more than 1,300 civilians have been killed and 10,000 detained since protests broke out across the country in March. Government crackdowns on dissenters have forced thousands of Syrians to flee across the border to Turkish government refugee camps. Turkey remains sympathetic to the cause of Syrian protesters and has called on the Syrian government to end the violence.
This is War News Radio. Anti-government demonstrators took to Tahrir Square in Baghdad again recently, protesting against corruption and the government's failure to deliver basic public services. War News Radio reporter Dina Sherhan spoke with the president of Iraq's leading feminist group about the violent response they encountered.
A group of female Iraqi activists took to the streets of Baghdad last Friday and were met with a violent confrontation.
They began to beat the feminists of my organization severely with those sticks.
That was Yanar Mohammed, the leader of the most influential feminist group in Iraq.
I'm the president of Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. Consider ourselves frontline feminists in Iraq who are secular, egalitarian. We work mostly on programs of violence against women.
The Arab Spring swept across Iraq in February, with demonstrators protesting against government corruption and failure to deliver basic public services. Dozens of protesters died on February 25th, the National Day of Rage. In response, Prime Minister Nourin Maliki said he would give the country's ministers 100 days to reform their policies, to reduce corruption and improve basic services. Protesters have just now taken again to Tahrir Square in Baghdad to mark the end of Maliki's 100-day time frame for reform. This time, Mohammed says her group was met with brutal force.
And we were surprised that there were some security people, very athletic people, dressed in civilian clothes, stormed at our activists. They were chanting slogans as to long live the sole leader, the Prime Minister Maliki. And they took the slogans that we were raising, they tore them apart and held the sticks in their hands and began to beat the feminists of my organization severely with those sticks while saying obscenities at them, as such as prostitutes, whores, and then began to sexually harass them in front of thousands of people, believing that this was the way to send political women home in humiliation.
Despite severe injuries, the women of OFI held a press conference to publicly express their devastation.
Conference is about to start, and we get surprised that there's a big military force comes and surrounds the offices, fills the street in front of our office, and three officials come into our organization, and they tell us that we are not allowed to hold a press conference, and they begin to speak in a very intimidating way with our activists and our supporters. And all of this happens for the mere reason that the women decided to come forward with their stories.
According to Mohammed, the same men who she said had beaten them on Friday in Tahrir Square were among those military forces who interrupted their conference.
After too many questions asked from the demonstrators, and especially the youth who were detained before and who knew who had detained them, it turned out that military force that came to our organization is from Division 56, who is responsible of the detainments and the torture of demonstrators. So they had dressed some of them in civilian clothes and asked them to come and beat up our women activists and to sexually harass them.
Yanar Mohammed said that in spite of threats from those government officials, members of OFI reported this incident to local and international media channels.
So the media, and some of them are international media like the Washington Post, decided to interview one of the women who was heavily beaten and harassed. After what the Prime Minister has done and thought he will send us back home, now he has a heavy scandal on his shoulders.
In response to these reports, members of international women's rights organizations publicly condemned Maliki's government for the assaults against OFI activists and declared Friday's attack as a crime and a fundamental violation of human rights.
They want an answer. Why were the OFI women beaten? Why were they molested and sexually harassed when they were just leading a peaceful demonstration?
Even with increased pressure from the Iraqi government exercising against activist groups, Mohammed said, members of OFI are determined to fight for the well-being of their country.
We are not closing until they arrest all of us.
Yanar Mohammed believes that Iraqi activists will continue to protest until the government responds to their demands. From War News Radio, I'm Dina Sherhan.
This is War News Radio. Conflict journalists are struck with a dilemma. They work in some of the most violent places on Earth, places where the danger is so random that it can affect anyone involved, regardless of their training, precautions, or role in the conflict. But at the same time, it is this very threat that provides them with a story to cover. This week, in part two of our series on conflict journalism, Stuart Russell talks with a photojournalist about the dangers of his profession and its very real and very personal consequences.
John Moore is not your average photographer. Since the early 1990s, he has traveled to some of the world's most dangerous places to cover stories for Getty Images, an American photo agency. He has covered the conflicts in Somalia, Bosnia, the Congo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the most recent conflict that he has covered, the civil war in Libya, was different.
They were near the front line, and there were mortars being fired, and there was a battle raging. And I would never say that they got too close. I would say that they were unlucky. It could happen to any of us.
On April 20th, one of Moore's friends at Getty Images, Chris Hondros, was killed by an RPG. Although the danger of conflict journalism is widely acknowledged, it is unusual for such a prominent and experienced journalist to be killed. Despite the dangerous consequences of his profession, Moore believes it is necessary to shed light on the conflicts in the Middle East. He remembers Hondros as one of the best and smartest photographers in the business.
He had covered conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, Liberia, and many other places around the world throughout his career, even more so than me. He was part of our sort of photo philosophers in this profession. He thought about consequences of his pictures. He thought very strongly that we needed to be covering these conflicts because without them, they would happen out of the public eye, and that was just completely unacceptable to him. He went back repeatedly to some of the most dangerous parts of the world, and we'll all miss him.
The same RPG that hit Chris Hondros on April 20th also killed Tim Hetherington, a British filmmaker who directed the Oscar-nominated documentary Restrepo about a U.S. military unit in Afghanistan. According to Moore, Hondros and Hetherington were not taking any unnecessary risks when the fatal RPG struck.
Chris was very smart at what he did. When he and Tim Hetherington were killed in Misrata, in sort of central western Libya, they were moving along the street, and they were doing everything right. I don't think they were taking any crazy risks. They were doing their job, and it still happens to even the best in this business.
Moore believes that the incident demonstrates that it often doesn't matter how experienced a journalist is or how close they are to the front line. It seems the random chaos of conflict can harm even the most trained and the most knowledgeable war journalists.
I've been in conflict zones once, for instance, in Iraq, where I was in a frontline situation, and some journalists 5 miles back behind me in the rear were killed by a rocket. And so there's no real safety when you're in a conflict zone like that. You try to manage the risk the best you can, but ultimately there's a matter of luck and destiny involved, and sometimes you just never know.
The deaths of Hondros and Hetherington evoked a profound reaction from the journalist community. The two photographers are the most influential and most accomplished journalists to be killed in recent years. Moore says the U.S. media has been very lucky throughout the conflicts in the Middle East.
Since 9/11, we've been covering wars constantly, and very few Western photojournalists, and certainly American photojournalists, have been killed. A lot of photojournalists and reporters working locally in Iraq, Iraqi photographers, Afghan photographers, Algerian reporters and photographers have been killed over these years. But in terms of people that I've known and people that I'm close to have known from the U.S. press corps, we've been very lucky.
As a result, the deaths had a large impact at Moore's photo agency.
When this hit, it was very tough for a lot of us. And it was really especially tough for those of us at Getty Images because we're very close to Chris. He's a colleague, he's a friend, and he's one of the best in the business.
The fact that these deaths occurred in Libya is significant. During his trip to Libya, Moore discovered the conflict zone was different from those in which he had previously worked. In Afghanistan, for instance, Moore was generally embedded with the U.S. military, who provided him with food, water, and transportation. In Libya, there are no U.S. troops on the ground to offer their protection.
You travel into rebel-held territory, usually from Egypt, at least that was in my case, and then you work along the front lines, and you are really, in many ways, on your own. When I was there, the rebels were not really controlling us that much. You could move around at will. These days, they set up checkpoints, and it's harder for journalists to get frontline access. But at the time, it was really up to us. And so traveling towards a frontline area, you would go with great caution.
While journalists in Libya can more easily access the story due to the nature of the conflict, there is a clear trade-off. The situation has been particularly dangerous for journalists and reporters. An unusually high number have been attacked, kidnapped, or killed. Moore believes that this is directly linked to the freedom that journalists are given.
We really had total access to the front line, which was shifting very quickly on a daily basis back and forth. And so it was really important to be very careful and pay attention very closely as to which way the battles were headed. And, you know, and as such, when a front line shifts overnight when you're sleeping, then if you're too close, then you might be in trouble, which is the case with a number of journalists who were captured. And so I think Libya has probably been more dangerous for us just because we've had so much complete frontline access the whole time. As a consequence, we've sometimes been closer than we would have liked.
Even though there are no U.S. troops on the ground to offer protection, Moore says that there are still precautions that journalists can take to avoid getting too close to the front line.
For instance, you'd make sure that there were cars in front of you moving in that direction and that there were cars coming back towards you on the highway from the other directions. And I don't mean cars flashing their lights and waving their hands. I mean, the worst thing you can do is drive down a highway in the open desert in Libya with no cars going in front of you and no cars coming towards you. That way you have no idea what's going on.
While the loss of Hondre serves as a reminder of the dangers of this sort of reporting, it will not change Moore's journalism career. He thinks that the role of a war journalist is as important as ever. Although the U.S. military is involved in multiple conflicts overseas, Americans, including many politicians, focus on domestic issues. Moore feels a sense of duty to tell the story that they are overlooking.
We have 100,000 soldiers plus over there. I think it's really important for Americans to remember that we have folks there and that people are getting hurt and dying all the time. And it's easy for people back home here who are going to the shopping mall and living their lives as normal, although dealing with the economy. People think a lot more about the economy than they do that we have two and a half, you could say, with Libya, wars going on at the same time.
Moore thinks it is discouraging to many in the military that the American public isn't paying attention to its wars. Moore and other conflict journalists believe so strongly that the conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya should remain in the public discourse that they are willing to risk their lives to keep it there.
When someone is killed in this profession, it's very difficult on many different levels. And so everyone wants to make sure that's not repeated. Will it be eventually? Well, this is a tough business. Of course it will be. But we hope it's not for a long time, and we hope it's no one we know. You know, and it's tough. It's much tougher when it's someone you know. It's just a fact.
Making America pay attention to its own wars involves a lot of risk. It means journalists like Chris Hondros, Tim Hetherington, and even John Moore himself have to put their lives at stake. According to Moore, the mission is worth the risk. For War News Radio, I'm Stuart Russell.
This is War News Radio. Earlier this spring, Basetrack, an experimental media group embedded with the Marines in southern Afghanistan, was told by the United States Marine Corps that their embed was canceled for no clear reason. That was just the beginning of the story. In this follow-up piece, Eliana Biscard Church caught up with Basetrack's decorated photojournalists, Balaz Gardi and Taru Kuyama, also the founder of the group, to get the full update.
Every story is memorable. These stories are just endless and numerous, and most of them are extremely sad.
Photographs, videos, and news articles pepper Basetrack's website, as photojournalist Balaz Gardi just reflected. An experimental media group, Basetrack embedded with the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, in Afghanistan's Helmand province in September 2010. Their goal was to use various media to chronicle the events, emotions, and experiences of the battalion for their loved ones back home. A large part of Basetrack's project was the use of social media to accomplish this goal. Little did they realize just how much insight social media could bring, from shed light on the military to prospects for the future of journalism.
Our embed was canceled.
It seems pretty clear that basically it came down to the Facebook page, and it also seems pretty clear that it wasn't actually anything that we did. What I kind of picked up was that there was this idea that the families were going negative, or that they were questioning the U.S. military mission in Afghanistan, and that there was a negative tone to the news articles that they were talking about or that were being put out on the Facebook.
As Taru Kuyama says, it seems as though Basetrack's use of Facebook was the major factor in their February 2011 cancellation. Kuyama revealed that the military even asked family members to remove negative comments on the Facebook page.
A big surprise was just how weird and kind of surreal all the stuff on the back end was, where you were seeing the way that mothers were being contacted, getting satellite phone calls from Afghanistan or emails from South Carolina telling them to, you know, delete something that they'd said on Facebook or to unlike the Facebook page or to do this or to do that. See this kind of strange sort of perception management campaign where you could see that it was actually incredibly important to some people what was being said just by the level of effort that they put into trying to control it.
In an article on Wired.com in March, Major Justin J. Ansel, the executive officer who originally invited Kuyama to embed with 1-8, admitted to emailing several family members to remove comments, usually on the basis that the posts were on what he called sensitive issues. The comments were often reporting negative results from combat and questioning the conflict in Afghanistan. As Wired reported, Major Ansel and the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Canfield, were pressured by officials in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Marine Attachment to U.S. Central Command, and Central Command Headquarters to shut down the Facebook page. Ansel asked Kuwayama to remove the Facebook page in January, and Kuwayama's refusal to do so eventually led to the cancellation of Basetrack's embeds. War News Radio attempted to contact Major Ansel and other officers involved, but received no reply. Despite the frustration of the cancellation, Kuwayama found the military's response to social media to be very enlightening.
Even this whole process of getting the canceled embed, it was fascinating in a way, and I think it was a really interesting window into the dynamics of these questions that the military is kind of grappling with. How do you deal with Facebook, or how do you control the flow of information, or should you?
Kuwayama says the Basetrack project raised many more questions for the military.
How is operational security defined, and can you actually regulate the things that your Marines say or express on the internet? And, you know, bigger question, can you control the things that their family members say? And probably bigger question, should you even try? We did this project at this time where the Marine Corps, at least, was just opening the door to social media, and you can see clearly in this example that the door is not all the way open.
Though the Marine Corps' response to Facebook could be seen by some as discouraging, Kuwayama called it growing pains, explaining social media as a transition and communication we all, not just the military, have to get used to. Meanwhile, because of the embed cancellation, the members of Basetrack had to leave 1-8 and Helmand Province. Two of their photojournalists, Balázs Gárdi of Hungary and Omar Mullick of London, decided to travel in Afghanistan. Gárdi was in Kandahar and then in Kabul, and ended up on a new mission for Basetrack.
In Kabul, I started visiting refugees, particularly looking for refugees who came from the area where this Marine battalion is operating. Instead of showing our audience the life of U.S. Marines, we tried to just show what Afghans go through really on the other side of the story. It was just the continuation of the Basetrack project.
Kuwayama agrees that Basetrack's mission lived on.
Process that we kind of hoped that would happen, that the families of these Marines were coming to Basetrack to learn about their sons or husbands or relatives, and in the process that they would come away with a broader understanding of what was happening in the region, the dynamics behind their really specific interests. That's basically how we, you know, tried to make lemonade out of this.
In his interactions with Afghan civilians, Gárdi learned much about the conflict in the country. He described how the Afghan people were at first overjoyed to have a U.S. presence in their country in the beginning of the war, and how this perception of the U.S. has steadily decreased.
Unfortunately, the constant mismanagement of the policy toward Afghanistan just took its toll, and now almost everyone, even the brightest and the most educated, basically just want the occupying forces out of the country, no matter what. People just feel that they left alone by the international community, left alone by their own government, and they just don't see ways out. And more people started to talk about Taliban-led sentiments.
Gárdi and Kuwayama shared more insights into the Afghanistan conflict, both believing that the U.S. mission is too scattered for success. Gárdi says he is skeptical.
This is what you see there, like intense fight. More and more ground is lost to insurgency, and I don't really see how that could be better. Throughout these 10 years, I saw a lack of imagination, lack of strategy. I always saw short-term goals, but I have not seen what would be the bigger picture, what would be the long-term solution.
Kuwayama agrees, describing the challenges as psychological.
We are still kind of fundamentally wrestling with this question of what are we trying to achieve and what level of commitment are we willing to give to it. And we still haven't articulated clear answers on this. And that is fundamentally the biggest problem. As long as we're tied to thinking about this in terms of how many months we're willing to be in Afghanistan. We've got some real sort of built-in hang-ups that prevent us from doing as much as we could.
These intimate views into the Afghanistan conflict, the policies, the people, the troops, comprise a rare perspective embedded journalists get to see. Kuayama and Gardi, both who had embedded many times before Basetrack, find value in this aspect. Gardi explained.
Being embedded is definitely a very great opportunity for journalists to observe not just the life of U.S. Marines or soldiers, depending on what kind of troops you're embedded with, but also policy in the making. It was always different. It's very interesting to see the progress, how policies are changing towards civilians, and just in terms of strategy and also goals.
Embedding allowed Basetrack to share these experiences with the loved ones of those in service, a rewarding responsibility both journalists spoke of greatly. The community Basetrack created has not only allowed support systems to grow, but has also begun a new view into the power of social media for individuals to connect and to tell their stories. Gardi found this exciting.
The most interesting part was not really creating images or reporting. What was, to me, the best outcome of this project is that we could prove that we can eliminate traditional media. We didn't really use news magazines and newspapers anymore. We created an online platform. What we created is a very strong community, Marine moms and friends who otherwise never really heard about each other.
Kuayama also sees inspiring potential for social media.
That to me is the hopeful part of this, because the journalism industry is in this crisis. And I don't think it's actually that bleak, because the future ultimately comes down to people being enabled or empowered to tell their own stories and to be journalists themselves.
He believes that online forums can help to begin such storytelling, and that Basetrack can be a great model for this.
That's basically where we are now with the project. Our piece of it, this part about following the Marines, is basically over. But what we're really focused on now is the actual system and figuring out what we can give to other people to do their reporting projects so that they can similarly tell their own stories and do their own projects. So that's ultimately the future, not what we did with it, but what everyone else will do with it.
The power of Basetrack's message to use social media to share stories will have lasting effects. Gardi plans to use the Basetrack model of online outreach in his projects, specifically in his work chronicling water issues through photographs and narratives on his website, facingwaterissues.org. Kuayama does not exactly know what is next. His current plans are to finish Basetrack's goal of making the media collected in Afghanistan available online for the families and friends of the Marines. Now Basetrack is publishing a book with images and stories of 1/8 and Afghan civilians. An online copy is available through their website at basetrack.org. Despite the 1st Battalion 8th Marines end of deployment in March, Basetrack's Twitter and Facebook pages with debates and discussions remain up and running. The end is certainly not in sight for Basetrack. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard-Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Dina Sherhan, Stuart Russell, and Eliana Biscard-Church. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sarah Dwider.
And I'm Clara Izupitis. Until next time, thanks for listening.